Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. At a remote little inn not far from the Kansas homestead of Laura Ingalls Wilder lived the Bender family. These pioneers welcomed unwary visitors with jackrabbit stew and a sledgehammer to the skull. In time, their apple orchard gave up its secrets, a burial ground for their mutilated victims, each stripped of their possessions. The devilish enterprise on Hell's Half Acre would earn the Bloody Benders an undying place in the annals of American infamy. But it was the mysterious fate of eldest daughter Kate that would make them the stuff of mythic campfire prairie tales. Little Slaughterhouse on the Prairie is part of Bloodlands, a chilling collection of short, addictive historical narratives from best-selling true crime master Harold Schechter. Spanning a century in our nation's murderous past, Schechter resurrects nearly forgotten tales of madmen and thrill killers that dominated the most sensational headlines of their day. The book that we're featuring this evening is Little Slaughterhouse on the Prairie, Bloodlands Collection, with my special guest, journalist and author and historian, Harold Schechter. Welcome back to the program, and thank you very much again for coming back to the program for this interview.
Well, happy to be here as always, Dan. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you very much. And let's get to a little bit about this Bloodlands collection before we get into Little Slaughterhouse on the Prairie. Tell us a little bit more about this collection.
Well, it's part of this new series called Amazon Original Stories, each story in Bloodlands, there are six of them altogether. Each one isn't meant to be read in one sitting, a couple of hours. They run about 40 or 50 pages, although they're only available as ebooks. They span, as you mentioned in your introduction, about 100 years of American criminal history. The first one is called The Pirate. It's about an 1860s mass murderer named Albert Hicks, who killed the entire crew and captain on board an oyster sloop in the 1860s. And then there's Little Slaughterhouse on the Prairie, which is set in Kansas in the early 1870s, as you mentioned, about the Bloody Bender family. The third one is about one of them is about this sex crime panic that gripped the country in the 1930s. There was a handful of very gruesome, sensational pedophiliac murders that happened in New York, and one very horrific one in Los Angeles. And this fueled this, I guess what sociologists call a moral panic, which was also partly fed by J. Edgar Hoover. The tabloids played a great role in creating this nationwide hysteria that the country was overrun, you know, with what they call these sex degenerates. Then there's one about an African-American serial murderer who is known as the Brick Slayer, who would sneak into bedrooms of women and murder them with a brick. He was the model for the character of Bigger Thomas in Richard Wright's classic book, Native Son. Then there's one on Howard Unruh, the first modern mass murderer in American history, this World War II veteran who shot to death a dozen of his neighbors in Camden, New Jersey in 1949. And then the last one is about Charles Schmidt, the so-called Pied Piper of Tucson, who is kind of a pre-Charlie Manson kind of character in the mid-1960s. So those six stories together, again, each one is a separate Kindle single, comprise the Bloodlands collection. And again, they're only available as on Kindle. They can be purchased individually or the...
Well, that sounds very, very interesting. Incredible stories. Let's get to this incredible story, Little Slaughterhouse on the Prairie. You open this up with the right in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about the inspiration of this, and we just mentioned that a little bit about Charles Ingalls Wilder.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the story of Little House on the Prairie. As everybody knows, we saw that on television. And you say that this is the story of these people moving to Big Woods of the Big Woods of Wisconsin. Charles Ingalls,
mm-hmm.
pioneering spirit, packed his wife and small children into a covered wagon and headed west
mm-hmm.
for the Indian Territory of southeast Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
Why the play on... little play on words, Little Slaughterhouse on the Prairie. Why is it inspired by this Little House on the Prairie? What about this story? Why is
mm-hmm.
Little House on the Prairie involved in this story,
mm-hmm.
Little Slaughterhouse on the Prairie?
Right. Well, later in life, after, you know, she had achieved a great deal of celebrity, Laura Ingalls Wilder's published a magazine article talking about all the stuff she had left out of her Little House on the Prairie books. You know, and she, you know, she discussed how, you know, there are all these events that she felt were not suitable for children, you know, that she actually heard about or witnessed, families, you know, freezing to death in these blizzards and, you know, cases of marital infidelity and, you know, various acts of violence. And in the course of the article, she mentioned that her family had actually had a couple of encounters with the Benders, and she also described, you know, a memory she had of her father having gone off and, you know, and returned one day and revealed that he had been part of the posse that had pursued and hunted down the Benders, although he supposedly, you know, refused to tell her specifically what had happened. But she had the distinct impression that her father, again, as part of this posse, had taken part in, you know, running down the Benders and lynching them. So, you know, for a long time, you know, people who, you know, were interested in Wilder and her life, you know, just took this, you know, as a matter of course. But later scholars have determined that, in fact, the Wilders had left Kansas before the Benders had set up their murder tavern. So, you know, this was a case of, you know, which happens very often, obviously, as one grows older, you know, some flawed, embellished memory.
Right. Very interesting.
What
she does write in that book, as well as saying that her father was part of this posse, and we're getting ahead of ourselves with the story, but also that
mm-hmm.
there was a couple encounters where the Benders had this tavern, and
mm-hmm.
they came to... On their way to their destination, they came to the tavern, but they didn't have the money, she said, to stop at the
right.
tavern. So
right.
to avoid what
yeah.
would have happened, certainly, to all those other people. And that was part of the other
yes.
facts that were part of her book, weren't it?
Yes, that is part of it, but again, that actually would not have apparently been possible because, in fact, you know, their dates in Kansas don't quite overlap. So yeah, I mean, kind of interesting, you know, the way in which one can, you know, revise one's past and become absolutely convinced that these things happened when, in fact, they didn't.
Yeah, absolutely. You say during Wilder's childhood, that Bender Tavern came to be known as the Devil's Inn, the Devil's Kitchen, Hell's Half Acre, and then now you say just recently historians have branded it Little Slaughter House on the Prairie. You talk about there was the, I guess, surprising amount of murders or plenty of murders in the region that was sparsely populated. And Utah, you mentioned notorious cities like Dodge City and then another city I hadn't heard of, Newton. And this is years after the Civil War. And you say this county organized in 1867. How was it that there was you talk about the treaty with the Osage Nation. How was it that people were coming to this area in fair amount of numbers? What was it that drove them to this area?
Well, I mean, in 1862, you know, the government passed the Homestead Act. So, you know, this was after the United States, after the Osage Nation, you know, ceded this great tract of their land to the government. You know, I mean, I guess most of us are, you know, familiar with the sort of sorry history of, you know, the way the U.S. government dealt with Native Americans. You know, they were constantly entering into these treaties, you know, taking over the land, you know, promising the Indians that, you know, they would be able to continue to reside on these large reservations in perpetuity. And then, you know, the more white settlers showed up, the more of the Indian land was appropriated. But in any case, in 1862, you know, the government passed the Homestead Act, which offered 160 acres of what was then public land, you know, to any settler who came and worked it for 5 years and lived on it and worked it for 5 years. So, you know, that obviously attracted a great deal of pioneers to the area.
Mm-hmm. You talk about in 1870, two individuals stopped in front of the trading post. You say run by Rudolph Brockman and his partner, August Earn. And this is in the southeast corner of the state, not far from Cherryvale. And you describe the driver as a slim young man, mid to late 20s, and just his nature, his behavior seemed like people might categorize him as a simpleton. And there was an older man sitting beside him. And you say it's not even sure whether it was his son or maybe his stepson. But
or not
what was it that they were
in any way.
They stopped in front of this in front of this shop here, what was it that they had in common? You say that there were Brockman and this person had something in common, and that he decided to
help them out. They were supposed to, I'm sorry, go ahead. Well, they were, you know, what they called back then Hollanders, you know, which basically meant that they were German in origin. You know, there's a lot of mystery that surrounds the origins and really even the relationship among, you know, the various members of the so-called Bender family. So, there was old man Bender and then, you know, this younger man who, again, we don't entirely know. I mean, you know, often described as his son, sometimes his stepson. You know, there are various accounts that claim, you know, that there was no familial relationship between them at all. But in general, you know, the consensus seems to be that he was you know, he was the son of Old Man Bender, you know, John Jr., you know?
Right.
And they had shown up, you know, like other settlers to the region, you know, to claim this land and to settle on it.
Now, you talk about right away they got some wood from neighboring town and they built a small little place. You say 16 by 24, so it's a small building.
Yeah.
And it's just the two of them that seem to have built this building, and then they
yeah.
sent for the women.
Yeah.
You describe they built a 16 by 24 foot building, and it was constructed mm-hmm. over a shallow cellar about 7 foot deep. And then they got a huge
yeah.
slab of sandstone, 7 foot
right.
by 3 inch thick, and that that served as the cellar floor. And then they had a
mm-hmm.
crude trapdoor that they built as well. And
mm-hmm.
later they dug a well, built a rough sod stable, and assembled a corn crib, which I'm not sure what that is, and a corral and pens for livestock. So they set up what kind of business? You talk about a tavern, but describe, as you do in the book, what really this looked like and was and functioned as.
Yeah, well, you know, photographs actually still exist of the Bender, quote-unquote, tavern. Yeah, but it was basically this one-room shack. They strung up this partition, which is sometimes, again, described as canvas, at other times, you know, another kind of light fabric. But in the front part of it, they built a rough counter and created this very rudimentary kind of grocery store. You know, they hung up a misspelled sign in front of the cabin, advertising it as a grocery shop. The cabin, by the way, you know, was built right by this what was called the Osage Trail, which was the main thoroughfare between you know, two of the major towns in that area. So they deliberately constructed this residence, you know, where travelers would pass close by, and they stocked it, you know, with a few meager provisions for travelers, but they would also offer food and lodgings to weary travelers, and they used the rear part of the shack as a kind of, again, very, very crude restaurant. You know, they had a table set up with some benches and so on, and then a couple of mattresses on the floor where all the Benders slept, and then if you wanted to spend the night there, you know, you can join them on the floor in another mattress.
You write in the book that soon after, or in 1871, but anyways, that two women arrived, and one
mm-hmm.
was Ma Bender, and the other one was, as you write, likely her daughter, 23-year-old Kate. And
mm-hmm.
you had even some question as whether what Elvira, if it was Elvira or Kate Sr., but anyway, they would
mm-hmm.
call her the Ma Bender, or, as you say, sometimes called the Old Hag.
Yeah.
And so, and both, you say, both of the kids, John Jr., that was supposed to be a little bit simple, and Kate were products of a previous marriage that she had. And now
you talk about
the four of them setting up this tavern.
Mm-hmm.
It's very interesting, and as we alluded to in the introduction, that Kate's role in this little enterprise here. So what does Kate end up publicizing herself as in terms of some of the skills and talents that she has?
Well, I mean, Kate, you know, supposedly was some kind of medium who would conduct spiritualistic seances. It's a little, again, you know, so many, as, you know, as with all notorious serial killers, particularly going back that far, all these myths and legends have grown up about her. But we do know for sure she, you know, that she advertised herself as a healer, because business cards still exist, actually.
Wow.
You know, that she would circulate. Professor Miss Kate Bender can heal all sorts of diseases, can cure blindness, fits, deafness, and et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, she was, you know, set herself up as this kind of quack physician. But her main role in, well, I don't know how far ahead of the story you want to get, but, mm-hmm. You know, her main role in terms of the family enterprise was apparently to distract unwary travelers who were eating, you know, at the Bender Inn, you know, while her father and brother dispatched them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you talk about, we'll get into the details right away with an example and a couple examples. Of course, you talk about some people were lucky enough to survive the Bender experience. And so in 1871, you say for a few weeks, Kate took a job mm-hmm. as a waitress in the Cherryvale Hotel, and she met Julie Hassler, a professed clairvoyant who shared her enthusiasm for telling fortunes and talking to spirits. And sometime that spring, you write, that Julie visited the Bender place after Kate invited her, and immediately you say Julie was struck by the squalor of this little shanty, but also the incredible foul stench wafting up from the floorboard, she said, and the blue bottle flies. You talk about a seance. What happens in this seance that makes her change her mind about her friend?
Well, according to her testimony, and again, let me emphasize, you know, that her testimony came after the Bender atrocities were uncovered. So one does always have to, you know, question its validity, because it is always the case when horrible crimes are discovered in some community in the past that people come forward to testify, you know, that they had come close to being killed themselves by these monsters. But according to Julie's testimony, you know, they were beginning the seance, and she closed her eyes and holding Kate's hands to summon up these spirits. And suddenly she was overcome with, as she described it, a terrible feeling. And when she opened her eyes, she saw the old hag, Ma Bender, and John Bender and Pa Bender suddenly approaching her. And Pa Bender had an axe in his hand. And, you know, Julie basically said she had to go to the bathroom and got out of there and fled. So, so that was her. You know, that was her experience. Again, maybe happened, maybe didn't happen. You know, there is some reason to doubt it. Namely, you know, the Benders basically chose victims, you know, that they were planning to rob and so on and so forth. And that, I don't know if that was the case with, you know, with Julie, but anyway, that was her story.
Mm-hmm. You say that about a month later, and this is May 1871, two boys find a man's decomposing body in a water hole just below a creek. And this is identified as William Jones, a stonemason who had gone missing on his way to Independence, which is along this route that we talked about. He was supposed to file a claim on some land in the next county. As we find with all of these cases, but this is the first one that authorities see, that people see, what is the state of the person's physical body, the things that would come to known as that signature of this killer?
Well, they all had, their skulls bashed in, the back of their skulls bashed in, and their throats were cut from ear to ear. I mean, you know, the throats of the Bender victims were gashed so severely that, you know, the heads were barely attached to the bodies anymore in some of the cases. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, you say, too, that whatever money was there was gone as well. And the police were searching the site. They didn't find any solid clues, but they did find a set of wheel tracks on the sandy bank made by a wagon whose rear axle was wider than the front. So that's the only thing they had, and very, very little anyway. And then you go ahead to January 7th, 1872, and Mrs. Leroy Dick. And you just say that she saw the old man and his son. They lived about 4 miles southeast of the Dick's place, of the home. But she said it was odd because the two men were heading away from their home towards the open prairie. Why would that be odd to her, and what does that develop into?
Well, it was odd because there was a snowstorm going on, and, you know, there would have been no particular reason why they were heading into the open prairie as opposed to heading back home as quickly as possible. You know, when she mentioned it to her husband, Leroy, you know, he basically said, well, you know, maybe they were just lost in the snow. But then when the spring thaw came, a couple of more, the bodies of two more men were discovered out on the prairie, basically in the direction that the two Bender men were headed when Mrs. Dick spotted them. And those two men, like the previous victim, had been murdered, you know, with their skulls had been crushed and their throats had been slit.
Yeah. And we talked about the William Jones, the stonemason who had gone missing, and he was found in that thaw. And you say during the following year, at least nine men traveling by themselves through Labette County went missing. And you write that in newspapers throughout the state, Southeast Kansas was earning a reputation as a perilous place for a lone traveler. And then you say within a month, Osage Township trustee Leroy Dick, again, we just mentioned him, received six letters from relatives looking for men lost heading in the direction of Labette County. And you say some of those men were thought to have been carrying substantial sums of money, especially for that time. You were saying William McCrady, $2,600, again, reportedly. Another man, John Greery.
$2,600.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And then you had another one, John Greery, believed to be carrying $2,000. Johnny Boyle, $1,900. And then they just had another man, Benjamin Brown. He only had $50, but he had a handsome wagon drawn by a well-matched team of Sorrel horses. So a valuable – he still had valuables. So and And you also talked about, too, that even one of the men was this Jack Henry McKenzie, was a distant relative of Leroy Dick's wife. So with all these reports, what do authorities – do? And you do introduce a person named Dr. William York.
Well, I mean, York was another victim. I mean, York, Dr. William York, ended up, you know, being the victim that kind of led ultimately to the uncovery of the Bender atrocities. But yeah, I mean, the you know the townspeople of Labette or you know the residents of Labette County, you know be you know because the area was starting to get you know such a terrible reputation, they at some point held a meeting and you know decided that they were going to make a concerted effort to try to track down you know whoever was perpetrating these crimes. But so
you talk about a man named George Longcore, and you say his wife died in childbirth, and he decided to leave Kansas with his infant girl and return to his parents' home in Iowa. He needed a suitable vehicle for the trip, and he struck a deal for a wagon with his friend and family physician, Dr. William York, as we introduced. And he set out for Iowa in late February 1873. He said the two of them made it as far as Coffeyville when a blizzard hit, and the pair took shelter at the home of a neighborly widow. And the widow was the last person, you say, to see George and his daughter alive. You say that, you write that it was Dr. York who discovered Longcore's belongings when he left his home to visit near Independence to visit his brother in Fort Scott. And once he was in the town, how did he discover this wagon? What was it that he heard stories about the wagon and the team abandoned in nearby wood. What did he find and what did he deduce from that discovery?
Well, again, Longcore had traded for, you know, this wagon and this this team with Dr. York, and you know, and set out presumably for Iowa, and then just disappeared. And the townspeople found this abandoned wagon and brought it into town, and then just by happenstance, York himself, you know, happened to be traveling, you know, went traveling to see his brother and stopped off of this town and just, you know, saw this wagon that had been abandoned and realized that was the wagon that Longcore had purchased from him. Other than the fact that he was very bewildered by this fact, you know, we don't know much more about how he reacted to it. But then he continued on his way, and then he disappeared. And it was when William York disappeared that his brother, Colonel Alexander York, he was a very, very prominent figure in the area. He was a senator, actually. You know, set out to find out what had become of his brother. And that, of course, ultimately led to the uncovery of the Bender atrocities.
Let's use this as an opportunity, Harold, just to stop for a second to talk about our sponsor, ZipRecruiter. You know what's not smart? Job sites that overwhelm you with tons of the wrong resumes. But you know what is smart? ZipRecruiter.com/murder. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't wait for candidates to find you. ZipRecruiter finds them for you. Its powerful matching technology scans thousands of resumes, identifies people with the right skills, education, and experience for your job, and actively invites them to apply. So you get qualified candidates fast. No more sorting through the wrong resumes. No more waiting for the right candidates to apply. It's no wonder that ZipRecruiter is rated number one by employers in the U.S. And this rating comes from hiring sites on Trustpilot with over 1,000 reviews. And right now, my listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/murder. That's ZipRecruiter.com/MURDER. ZipRecruiter.com/murder. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Now, Harold, we talked about the Colonel Alexander M. York, brother to Dr. William York. You say in your right in your book, he's not a man to be trifled with. He practiced law in 1861 before enlisting as a private with the 92nd Illinois Volunteers. In 1863, he rose to colonel. And several years of law practice, and he established a newspaper. So this person is looking for to avenge his brother's death, to look into what he hears about rumors of what may have happened. How does it happen
At that point, he was not so much looking to avenge his brother's death, since he wasn't sure that his brother was dead. But he was certainly trying to discover what had become of his brother, who had just vanished.
Now,
so he assembled a search party, and they began to retrace his brother's route, which ultimately led to the Bender Tavern. And when they arrived there, they encountered John Jr., who verified that a man matching Dr. York's description had stopped by there sometime earlier, about a week earlier or so, and then ridden off. And John Jr. speculated that maybe York had been waylaid and murdered by a gang of outlaws who, who were sort of camped out in some nearby spot. John led the posse to the place of the ambush, the alleged ambush. Of course, they didn't find anything. So, York and his posse rode off. And it was shortly thereafter that a large group of men from Osage Township, call this meeting and agreed that they were going to search every homestead in the vicinity to see if they could somehow, turn up evidence that one of the local residents was responsible for this series of murders that was casting such a blight on the name of the whole county.
Mm-hmm. You write, though, that what's very haunting is that when they went for the fruitless search with John Jr., they returned to the Bender home and they were greeted there by Kate. And accounts were, again, that York knew of Kate's psychic abilities and proposed that she use them to locate missing brother. And she said she went into a trance and she said spirits were reluctant to assist. There was too many unbelievers around. And she told him to return the next day, but on one condition. What did she say that one condition was? And what did he do in response to that?
Well, the condition was that he'd come by himself. But York did not take her up on that invitation, and by implication saved his own life.
Sure. You talk about a week later after this meeting, and at that meeting as well, the two Bender men are at that meeting, and they leave, apparently board their wagon and they leave. About a week later, a man named Charles Nelson, a resident of Thayer, Kansas, about 10 miles north of where the Bender's home is, was passing through a ravine outside of town. He found a dilapidated wagon abandoned with two half-starved horses. And you say the editor of the Thayer Headlight, a newspaper, examined the wagon. What did they find in that wagon? It was very interesting.
Well, they found the misspelled sign that the Benders had hung up on their shack, advertising it as a grocery.
Yes.
And, you know, the wagon also was notable because, again, it was constructed very oddly, you know, with the rear axles wider, axle wider than the front axle. In other words, you know, it was the wagon whose wheels matched the tracks that had been found earlier at the location where one of the first victims had been found.
Absolutely.
But,
yes.
You know, what was the interesting thing about that meeting, clearly Pa Bender and John, you know, realized it was time to hightail it out of there because, you know, this all the male residents of the county, you know, were eventually going to descend upon their farm and, you know, discover the horrible truth about what was going on there.
Yes, you write that it takes 3 weeks after that wagon is found, and the neighbor, Silas Tolles, notices that the Benders' farm looks unoccupied. He sees the cattle and hogs and horses are all wandering around. He found the house deserted and the horse and wagon gone, and he found a starved calf. So Tolles contacts Leroy Dick, the town trustee, who sent word to Colonel York. So you talk about Colonel and a large party of men, I think 15, arrive at the border, at the Bender place. Tell us what they find.
Well, they find evidence that the place had been vacated in a hurry. They find a number of hammers, including a very large 6-pound hammer. They find a German Bible with these inscriptions on the inside cover, including one enigmatic entry, Slag Day, Slagh Day. And what they also discover is this: the place was just pervaded, you know, with this incredibly fetid odor. And they trace that odor to this trap door, in which they lifted, and the stench arose. It was so foul, you know, that it drove the men outside. So they actually managed to lift up and move the entire shack, you know, and take up the floor. And they discovered this little cellar with a stone slab on the bottom, which was, you know, just coated with clotted gore, which was the source of the stench. They got a sledgehammer and shattered the slab, and the earth underneath it was just saturated with dried blood.
You talk about the amount of bodies that they find there and the excavation that they undertake, and right after this, right after they, you say that one eerie part too is the colonel recognizes his brother, and his head is cut ear to ear. You say his throat is ear to ear. His head falls off from is separated from his body when his brother's searching through that. It's this horrible scene. You talk about immediately after this, though, they're looking for somebody to prosecute, and oddly, they look at Rudolf Brockman, the trading post proprietor. Why is
just
that?
Just to backtrack for a minute. Yeah, I mean, after discovering, you know, all this, again, you know, this blood-drenched cellar, beneath the floor of the shack. They start looking over the property, and York climbs a tree, and he spots what appeared to be a grave in this nearby apple orchard. So the men go over there and dig this makeshift grave up and discover the remains of York's brother, William York. And then, in a short order, they excavate the graves, of about 10 or 11 other victims, including that of George Longcore, who had been thrown into the grave with his infant daughter. And the infant daughter, there was evidence that the infant daughter had been buried alive with her father. Obviously the men are appalled, horrified, enraged, and they turn on Rudolf Brockman, partly or largely because, he, like the Benders, was German. He was the first person who had encountered the Benders when the Benders first arrived, and had given them some, advice and assistance. So their immediate, the posse, again, it was this inflamed mob, reacting the way mobs often do. And, they immediately turned on Brockman and strung him up. And then, till he was almost dead and then cut him down. They basically, were trying to torture a confession out of him. And of course he had nothing to confess. So
you do write that it's very interesting though, that 23 years later, however, he was convicted of first degree murder, torture of his 16-year-old daughter.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's one of the horrible
coincidences,
but yes, but at the time, he was certainly, innocent of anything to do with the Benders. So, but it was, an example of, again, this mob mentality, which sadly often overtakes large groups of people under those kinds of circumstances. So.
You write about another close neighbor, the other adjoining neighbor, Thomas Tyack. He was said to be a frequent visitor to the Bender home. He was also tortured in the same way with the rope, lowering and stringing him up a few times to try to choke a confession out of him. And they eventually let both of these men go when they didn't get a confession and they were.
Mm-hmm.
Now you talk about it. You have an excavated grave photo here in your book as well. I just thought I mentioned too that you do have some excellent photos included in this book as well, of the time, 1873 and other dates. There was no eyewitnesses, but the chroniclers of the time, you say the newspapers grabbed this story and was a sensation. What was the scenario that you say that chroniclers came up with on how these people preyed on these lone travelers?
Well, basically the traveler would be invited to take a meal at this table, which was sort of like a picnic table kind of thing. He would be facing, his back would be to this canvas partition, with his head very close to it. Presumably, Kate would distract him and entertain him and beguile him while he ate. Meanwhile, on the other side of the partition, Pa Bender and or John Bender, would come up with one of these hammers. And when the unwary traveler would lean his head back, they would smash his skull through the partition. And then, again, nobody knows for sure. Some people thought they would then dump him down into the cellar, finish him off by slitting his throat. Other people speculated that they would just, tilt him back and slit his throat, and just the blood would run down into the cellar. And then they would wrap him up and you know, when it got dark, bury him in the apple orchard. So, but one way or another, it seemed, you know, there was from, you know, from the stains that they found on this cloth or canvas partition, you know, it seemed pretty certain that's how they would murder these people. You know, they would be sitting there having a meal, and one of the benders, men, would come up with a hammer and smash their skulls.
Was there talk of any other mutilation?
Yeah, well, when they, you know, and again, exactly why, or, you know, this was done to some of the bodies, but when they dug up some of the bodies, it seemed clear that some of the men had been castrated.
Well, yeah. Now, with the newspaper reports, and you say this instantly became a sensation, and not only were the graphic details reiterated over and over again, but rumors turned into, I guess, well-received rumors and became facts in certain people's minds. So this story took on a life of its own in terms of the rumors becoming facts. And very interesting what happened to the home itself, with it becoming, you say, an instant tourist attraction. I thought it was almost unbelievable. What happens to the building itself, the farm?
Yeah, well, you know, it is and it isn't unbelievable, in the sense that, you know, when you research these crimes, as I've done, you know, the book that I came out with, which I think I was on the program with you to discuss, Hell's Princess, about Belle Gunness.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, which was a very sensational case that happened about, I guess, 30 years after the Bender case. You know, you see the same thing, and you see this very, very frequently. You know, there are some very notorious cases. There is something called the Red Barn murder in England, where you see the same thing. You know, these sites become instant tourist attractions. They attract thousands and thousands of curiosity seekers, you know, who immediately come, you know, by whatever means they can get there. I mean, you know, they have excursion trains and so on and so forth. And these become, you know, there's a very, very festive carnivalesque atmosphere. You know, hundreds, thousands, really, of curiosity seekers just immediately arrive on the site and start scavenging, you know, for all kinds of souvenirs, you know, what people now call murderabilia, you know, basically, you know, dismantling the shack, you know, taking every scrap of wood as a souvenir, you know, anything they can find, you know, clumps of dirt and grass from the grave sites. You know, there's just this, you know, powerful human desire, you know, to somehow acquire these evil relics from these infamous murder sites. You know, that again, you know, we say it's unbelievable, but in fact it's all too believable, because it just happens all the time. You know, when the crimes of Ed Gein were uncovered, you know, local residents in Plainfield, Wisconsin, they burned down his house because they knew, you know, it was going to attract all of these ghoulish souvenir hunters. Same thing happened, you know, with Jeffrey Dahmer's place in Milwaukee. You know, if the place isn't torn down by the authorities, it's just going to attract people who are coming, you know, to get a little. You know, piece of memorabilia. So,
sure. You write about, and we mentioned the posse that was organized by Colonel York and some of his important men, but also that there was three other, we'll say, very official posses that went after these men, despite the head start that you say that the Benders had, probably a week or so. And there was some other official lawmen and also other amateur sleuths that joined in on this. There was a considerable reward. But there is, of course, nobody apprehends these people, but there are stories. And there are many stories about accounts of what really happened in terms of vigilante groups. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, again, you know, a lot of mystery still surrounds the Bender case, as, for example, you know, it does with the Belgunas case. You know, nobody knows what happened to them. There were all kinds of, there was various stories, you know, that different posses, you know, there are people, again, you know, Laura Ingalls Wilder, you know, who somehow claimed to have direct knowledge that, you know, that the Benders were hunted down by one posse or another and lynched. You know, then there were other stories that they escaped. And, you know, as is often the case with notorious killers, who somehow managed to evade the law. You know, there are these different sightings of the Benders in Cape Bender, you know, for decades, really. In fact, you know, there were stories when Belgunas' crimes were uncovered, and, you know, this is 30 years after the Bender crimes. You know, there were newspaper stories that Belgunas was Cape Bender. Yeah, I mean, again, that's kind of typical in these cases. You know, there are stories that they had escaped and were living in France. And then, well, yeah, so, but nobody knows for sure.
You have this, but many stories were that they were, that they met their rightful end at the hand of vigilante posse. And some horrendous things, but at least they were shot dead. And a lot of the accounts, it was very similar, that they were just eliminated. They were shot dead. There was varying reports that maybe somebody attacked them or wanted to attack them. They had one of the stories was, of course, Kate was armed with a knife and was slashing at them. And you even had one story where Colonel York somehow had Kate gave her the ability to escape while the others were killed, and then she went on to live in Canada. You include an incredible story in here, so this story does not end, includes a person named Frances McCann, and you say she had a terrible dream, and she told her washerwoman, Sarah Davis, about this dream. Tell us a little bit about this dream and what happens as a result.
Yeah, I mean, totally bizarre story. It was, I guess, around the mid-1880s, 1886 or so, which was more than a decade after the uncovery of the Bender atrocities. Yeah, right. So this woman had a terrible, this woman, Frances McCann, who was living in Kansas, suddenly had a dream that she heard a scream in the cellar and ran down and saw a guy with his throat cut. And she mentioned this to this widowed washerwoman named Sarah Davis, who did laundry for her. And Sarah Davis said, "That was no dream. You know, that actually happened to you when you were a child." And just this wild, wild, wild story, claiming that Mrs. McCann's mother, Elizabeth, was her, that is, the washerwoman's sister, and that the mother, Elizabeth, you know, had married this guy, John Sanford, and that Elizabeth's other sister, Rose, it's such a bizarre story, I don't even remember all the details, had fallen in love with him, and that the washerwoman's other sister, Rose, and their mother, Elmira, had conspired to murder Mrs. McCann's father in the basement.
Right.
Anyway, totally bizarre story, but somehow Mrs. McCann became convinced that the washerwoman, Sarah, and her mother were actually Kate and Ma Bender.
Mm-hmm.
And she managed to persuade the authorities and other people, including Leroy Dick, whose name has come up a number of times in our discussion, that these two women were in fact Ma and Kate Bender. And anyway, through, you know, this completely bizarre Baroque way, these two women ended up getting arrested and put on trial. Anyway, they were able to ultimately prove definitively that they could not possibly have been the Benders, mainly because they were both in, I mean, they were shady characters
yeah.
who had many, many run-ins with the law. But their defense attorneys were able to provide documentation that they were both actually in prison at the time the Benders were perpetrating their crimes. So, but again, it was, you know, kind of a striking example, you know, of the way in which the Bender stories kept this mm-hmm. grip on the popular imagination, and the way in which, you know, for years and years and years, there continued to be these sightings of the Benders.
Now, as you say, there's so many, the legend has it that there's so many names for the Devil's Kitchen, the Devil's Inn, and the Little Slaughterhouse on the Prairie. Again, incredible story. Refuting, of course, Laura Ingalls Wilder's tale, of course, of that she was and her family had an encounter with the Benders. But as you say, as you write, there's so many accounts of so many people that wanted to be associated with this crime, either with a piece of a souvenir, a piece of wood, anything from that entire building was, you say, entirely mm-hmm. carted away, every single mm-hmm. stone and piece of wood. But also that people wanted to be associated with being a near victim, close encounter,
mm-hmm.
or people that wanted to claim that they were actually there, or they knew firsthand of people that were involved in the posse that took revenge for those murders.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, again, that's very, very, very common phenomenon. You know, I've in my researches into various crimes, I'm always coming across that. You know, when Ed Gein's crimes were discovered in 1957, you know, he had all these people, you know, come forward to claim that, you know, Ed Gein had offered them, you know, packages of venison, which
oh, yeah.
they then realized, you know, were probably human flesh. When the crimes of H.H. Holmes were uncovered, you know, there are all these people claiming, you know, that they had checked into his so-called murder hotel, you know, and barely escaped with their lives. You know, when Bell Gunness's crimes were discovered, people came forth, you know, claiming that they had stopped off at her farmhouse and had close calls with her. So, you know, it's hard to, you know, some of these people are just kind of publicity hounds who want to get their names in the newspapers, you know, and others, you know, just have very overheated imaginations and I think really convince themselves somehow, you know, that these things really happened. But it's not at all unusual. In fact, on the contrary, you can almost count on something like that happening, you know, when a crime like this is uncovered.
Yeah. It's an amazing phenomenon.
I just met somebody, by the way, you know, a couple of weeks ago, you know, who claimed that Jeffrey Dahmer asked him out on it, or claimed that he knew somebody, a cousin or whatever.
Okay.
You know, and this person claimed that Jeffrey Dahmer had once asked him out on a date. You know, I mean, could be true. But, you know, my own experience with these matters convinces me that probably didn't really happen. But
yeah, absolutely. It's a strange phenomenon that we think is, we've probably discussed this before, that we think it's a modern phenomenon, but it isn't. And the kind of behavior that people might find disgusting now in terms of behavior, memorabilia sites, and people buying, you know, art and mementos from serial killers, is that pales in comparison to what the kind of behavior people exhibited in the past.
Oh, absolutely.
Involving killers.
Well, I mean, there were, you know, people would, when Burke and Hare, you know, the notorious British body snatchers, I guess, I can't remember which one was executed, Burke or Hare, one of them, I think Burke was executed. Anyway, whichever one was executed, you know, somehow parts of his skin were flayed off and made into tobacco pouches, you know, which were sold to people. You know, people would, I myself, you know, have seen among the bizarre collections of some of the people that I have encountered in the course of my career as a true crime writer and researcher, you know, who have, you know, like preserved, you know, fingers from executed criminals. So, you know, the urge to collect ghoulish mementos and souvenirs of, you know, these sensational crimes, you know, that's really an age old human phenomenon. Well, look, I mean, it's not that different, you know, from Aboriginal tribes keeping shrunken heads or whatever, you know, of their enemies. You know, human beings have always kept, again, ghoulish souvenirs of horrible crimes. So.
Yeah. Not so surprising. Yeah, and even the hair on the victims of the benders, apparently, or supposedly, that hair was cut, and it was a real coup for somebody to get a few curls from the baby of his infant baby. So, yeah, very interesting. I want to thank you very much, Harold Schechter, for coming on and talking about Little Slaughterhouse on the Prairie, a part of the Bloodlands collection. For those people that might want to take a look at your other work, give us your website and Facebook page, if you could, please.
Well, haroldschechter.com. My Facebook page, that's a really good question. You know I have a Facebook page, but I never go on it. It's
sorry
actually
for that. That's a hard question.
To me by, yeah. But, you know, I guess the best, you know, I guess Googling my name is always a way that one can discover more about me and my work. So.
Absolutely. I want to thank you very much, Harold, for coming on. Hope to talk to you again real soon. Thank you very much for this interview.
Yeah.
You have a great night.
Thanks.
Good night.
Thank you, Dan. It's always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure, Harold. Thank you. Good night.
Thank you.